This is Cameron Marceau with Black Liver Project here for another episode of Monster in a Glass. We are doing another classic cocktail, not as old as the last one we did, but they all can't be that old. Though I did find a source that would let us do a lot more of those. And maybe we can get a dirty tankard for it next time.
It's like booze and a dirty tankard.
Yeah. I
that
feel,
sounds like a drink itself.
I'll have another dirty tankard, please.
So the cocktail we're doing today is called The Blinker. And I'm joined today by my good friend Jason Cruz, who's done some research on The Blinker.
Yeah. Let's start with saying there's not a whole lot about the drink itself.
That's when I looked, I didn't see jack shit.
It actually only,
I saw a date of 1930s.
It shows up in the official mixer's manual, Patrick Gavin Duffy, 1934, and that's the only place I could find it listed.
Right after Prohibition.
Right after, almost like a year after Prohibition, if even a year. And I don't have a lot of information about the drink itself, but some interesting things about the ingredients, what was going on at that time. All said, the ingredients aren't totally remarkable either. You have rye, grapefruit juice, and the original recipe calls for grenadine.
Well, I don't think I've seen a grapefruit juice cocktail yet.
Aha, and I did research as to maybe why.
Okay.
Let's start with the name.
Okay.
You know, because I couldn't find anything, and because Ted Hay says, I'm going to get not necessarily into a Ted Hay bashing, but I'm going to point out a couple flaws in his logic. So they call it a blinker. But if you look up what the name of the blinker, what blinker means, I mean, it essentially means blinders, which is what he says. That's not too far off. You know, it's a horse blinders, essentially.
Those flaps that go over the horse's eyes.
Right.
To keep them looking straight.
Right. And I mean, really, that kind of makes sense. A drink that will make you blind to anything else but the drink.
Okay.
You know, it could also mean goggles, or like the glasses that were used for the purposes of straightening your vision or your eyes. They called them directing the sight in one direction, or pure squinting, or to protect the eyes from cold or dust. So there's that, which seems logical. It's blinding. But there is another definition that starts in the early 1800s and goes on through the 1950s in the U.S., where blinker means a black eye. So there's no way to tell where the name of the drink came from or why it was named that. Because it's not showing up anywhere else, I presume it was Patrick Duffy that... Not Patrick Duffy, the actor. Patrick Gavin Duffy, the bartender, who came up with the drink. So, it's probably because of the blinders aspect of it. But it would be nice to think that he created it because it makes you fight and get black eyes. But I'm guessing that's not actually the case when you learn about Patrick.
Those are the drinks being mixed right now. Okay, so...
The other interesting thing about this recipe is that... And I'll go into more... some information about Patrick Gavin Duffy. He really preferred that drinks be stirred and not shaken. Only, he said, in like a rare few exceptions, all cocktails should be stirred. But this was one where he actually...
He shook it?
Shook it. Huh. And he would shake if somebody requested it, but he said it was better, it didn't bruise. It would end up bruising the ice, but the ice would break, so it would melt, cloud it up.
Okay.
But for this recipe, he actually did shake it.
So, did you find out more about him?
I did. I want to talk a little bit about the ingredients first, and then I'll go into it. So I'll say also, so looking around, I couldn't find this drink at all in any other recipe book. You find things that are pretty close to it in Straub's Manual of Mixed Drinks. There's a recipe for a grenadine sour, which is lemon juice, grenadine, and bourbon. And there's also a grenadine fizz, which is lemon juice, grenadine, and rye or bourbon. And here we are about to taste it. Very citrusy smelling.
Yeah,
obviously
smell.
It's rimmed with lemon.
I can smell it from behind the camera. Here.
Not extremely citrusy tasting.
No.
In fact,
it's all you smell.
It is. It's interesting because it is. It's all you smell, but then when you taste it, it's pretty much.
Do you like grapefruit juice? I know you like rye, right?
I do. I do like rye a lot. I don't.
Do you like raspberries?
Yeah.
Do you like grapefruit? Grapefruit is always.
Grapefruit's all right.
That's the iffy one. More people are likely to turn their nose at grapefruit.
I don't taste any grapefruit juice at all.
Really?
I taste. Now, I just got a little bit on that taste, but I taste more like a subtle taste of the rye. The citrus isn't overpowering. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely
juice. You're tasting
juice.
A perfectly blended drink.
I am. That is exactly what I'm tasting.
It's not one of anything, you know? Mm.
Yeah. Like, nothing is overpowering. It's very good.
That is very good.
Which is weird, because, obviously, he rimmed the glass with lemon, which is giving off the citrusy smell.
Yeah.
But the grapefruit juice is not overpowering.
It's not.
The raspberry syrup is not.
And neither is the rye.
And neither is the rye. Yeah.
I don't know if it makes me feel hot or cold, you know? Generally, I feel like whiskey is kind of...
Yeah, a warmer...
It makes you tight. It makes you... It's not relaxed.
Gives you whiskey face.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is... Yeah, it's not overpowering. Yeah, I don't know if it's a cool. To me, I feel like it could be any time of year drink.
Oh, sure. I think
even as
many drinks are like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think all drinks are like that. But
it's cold and.
Yeah, and yet you get the warmness of the rye, but you're not. You're not like. Overpowered by the.
I'll tell you this though, I could drink whiskey as well. I don't normally. I think I like this better than a Jack and Coke, you know?
It masks it really well. And I don't know if it's the grapefruit juice.
But it's not like really sweet.
Right. Well, and that's interesting. So as I was saying, you can't really find a whole lot. You can find. You know, related drinks that have lemon juice. You know, there's a couple that I found that have grapefruit juice in it around the same time. I looked into grapefruit juice because I was trying to figure out, well, how common of an ingredient was this? So, searching through these recipes books, it doesn't really show up before the 1910s. So,
really,
you do get, and even then, it was hard to find because I was like, why? I mean, even how
was
could
grapefruit
it?
A fruit before
it
before
was
the
based on what
20th
I,
century?
Yeah.
I mean, of course it was. Where was it? Was it available?
From what I was finding, it was available in Florida, but it wasn't very popular. And I think it was what I read was because of the
it blinds you.
It blinds you. Because of the peel is so thick that it wasn't really people just didn't want to mess with it. I mean, why would I peel this? Just to get at something that's similar to an orange, you know. But it does start showing up as grape space fruit in the 1910s, here and there. But really in the 1930s, after Prohibition, you start seeing it much more. So the Duffy book has several recipes with grapefruit juice. One called Along the Wine Trail has several. And the only one where I could actually find grapefruit mentioned earlier than that was one in 1906 that just said you scoop out all the pulp out of the peel and then use that as a bowl. So they weren't didn't seem like they were then interested.
Don't eat that stuff, it's nasty.
So right like that. The pulp shit isn't gonna help you at all. Just put booze in it. So around 1920, the California Fruit Growers Exchange, which actually became Sunkist, started a big advertising campaign right at the beginning of Prohibition, roughly at the same time. And so as they did this, they started huge advertising campaigns for citrus fruits, oranges, grapefruits, and fruit juices, and promoting it as having vitamins. They discovered it actually had vitamins. So that was a big push for that. So Florida growers started doing it, and they said from this one source, which is the Oxford Companion of American Food and Drink, fruit juice sales increased threefold in 2 decades.
Well, yeah, because advertising back then was like shooting fish in a barrel.
Right.
Yeah. It's like you hold up a sign that says buy fruit, and everybody goes, oh, okay, I'll buy fruit.
Chocked with vitamins.
Yeah. Chocked with vitamins.
Vitamins. You know, another source I found said that before that, fruit juices, they weren't really that interested in. Now, if you look at recipes,
there's fruit and fruit juices and sure. Cocktails way back.
You're absolutely right.
But they squeezed it.
Exactly. They were squeezing it. They were turning it into syrups. They were turning it into bitters. They were squeezing their fruit. But around the same time as them promoting, it became popular to can fruit juices.
Okay.
And then it started becoming a common, when Prohibition started, it became more common for people to drink fruit juice instead of booze because they couldn't get it. So there's that. The other thing is, and I didn't even know this before researching, is that there were exemptions in the Volstead Act. I thought it was just no booze at all, anytime. Apparently, you could make booze at your house for personal consumption. And you could ferment fruit juices during that time. It was for you only, in your house, which clearly people didn't abide by. So, you know why grapefruit juice starts coming about? I mean, if the growers are doing big advertising, if they start canning it, and you have bathtub gin, that is essentially undrinkable, they started masking it with fruit juices, ginger beer, soda.
That makes a lot of sense.
So
something as strong as grapefruit juice.
So that seems to be the explanation why it starts showing up post-prohibition as opposed to before.
That was the story with honey in the Bevo.
Exactly. I mean, and I think it makes sense. I mean, that's the most logical. It's going to be very.
And the creme de menthe from the stinger.
Mm-hmm.
Except that was also, it was to mask it on your breath. It's like, I just drank scope.
I was eating piles of mint. So, I can't do one of these without just disputing what Ted Hay says, because in this one he wasn't too wrong, but he does make sweeping statements that I have to call out, because I just checked on him. I wasn't looking necessarily, I'll admit, I was looking to dispute things that he said. I was disappointed when the blinker, I was like, oh no, he's sort of right. You know what? But with the raspberry syrup, so he says that raspberry syrup was a common substitute for grenadine in the 19th century American recipes and in Prohibition era European recipes. Well, that sort of is wrong, because grenadine doesn't actually show up in the 19th century. It's made from pomegranate. So, if you look at Jerry Thomas's book, he actually makes a syrup out of pomegranate, but it's not grenadine. It's something else. I forget what it's called. It's more of a liqueur or a wine.
So, when did grenadine appear?
It starts appearing. Now, this is interesting. I found a blog, and you probably like it. It's called the Alcademic. And he had done so much research on the history of grenadine that I was comfortable with saying he is an authority on the history of grenadine. I mean, he searched a lot of the same things, and he really found what I was finding, that you don't really start seeing anything until the late 1800s, like 1895, you start seeing something with grenadine in it. But that's about it. I guess the French were using it as not really to mix, but like to just drink.
As the French are wont to do.
As the French are wont to do. by the 1910s or 1920s, it starts, you start seeing it more. So by that logic, saying that raspberry syrup was a common substitute for grenadine is wrong in the 19th century. The other thing is, there is not really a thing as European prohibition. I had to look this up because I thought, oh, did they? Was there a European prohibition? And at first when I was thinking about it, I thought, how? You can't. Europe is a country of, you know,
Europe is not a country.
Continent of many countries is what I would say. Europe's a country. I'm saying it now.
Yeah. It's not a country like Africa.
Yeah, right. Thank you for correcting me. Europe is a continent of countries that weren't all following the same rules.
But but there was a period where everybody was seeing alcohol as the boogeyman.
Right.
And they were making different laws and stuff like that, right?
That's true. And what I could find on it is that in Europe, and more specifically Northern Europe, they did do prohibition-like laws. I think there was only one country, and I want to say it was Finland, who did straight-out prohibition. But it wasn't because of the ills of alcohol. It was because they just gained their independence from Russia. And that was a way of spitting back in Russia's face of, hey, we're our own country now. You guys drink too much booze.
And we're not going to be like you.
So, manner. But like other countries, they did things like, you can't drink things over 20% alcohol.
Yeah.
Like, okay. And like, or did you can French, only drink did, beer on...
Did the French shun wine?
No. France was not part of it. I mean, it was mostly like, you know, Denmark, Finland, Sweden. And it was variation. So there really wasn't a European prohibition necessarily. But they did start doing, and it was roughly the same time period. This is a really good drink.
It is. I'm enjoying it immensely.
You know, I think the lemon makes it almost seem like a summer drink. But I would say you could drink this really any time. It's very smooth.
It is.
So, Patrick Gavin Duffy, what's it?
You just like it because he's, like, Irish.
Well, that helps, but...
You're like an Irishophile.
I am. What do you call it? An aerophile?
An aerophile?
Aerophile.
I don't know.
A greenophile. So, he's interesting because... What a lot of these bartenders of that time period did was write forwards to the recipe books and tell, not only give you recipes, but tell you how you were supposed to bartend. And so he was one of them. So this is mostly from his foreword and bits and pieces I could find other places. But, I mean, he didn't write biographies really about, you know, about bartenders necessarily. So he was a bartender at the Ashland House in New York from 1884 to 1893. He didn't write this book until 1934. So he was sort of a bartender of the old school, and there was a period of time in the mid-1800s when if you walked into a saloon, you could really just expect to be, you know, blinded by moonshine, robbed of your goods, or freely give it up, for, you know, because you were slipped a monkey. I mean, they weren't necessarily... upstanding places. Not all of them were bad, but like, you know, a good number. And that was actually the reputation a lot of them had anyway. But the Ashland House and Patrick Gavin Duffy, Harry Johnson, which was another big bartender, and to some extent Jerry Thomas.
What was his name?
Harry Johnson. I know, right? You're like, you weren't
no.
in the 1880s, you made that up.
No. Okay.
Yeah, Harry Johnson, the bartender.
Okay.
So, they really believed in that, that this was a dignified profession, it was creative, you should act a certain way, but it really spoke to class, I mean, who they were serving. They worked in establishments that served the upper class.
Yeah.
Saloons more catered to the run-of-the-mill, you know, gin-soaked, you know...
Press gang
drunk. Yeah. He goes up and is forward about what he likes. And this is sort of like Harry Johnson also does the same thing. It's supposed to be like a gentlemanly business, you know. But some of the things that they believed in, that bartenders should be neatly shaved, have clean fingernails and fingers and hands, and wear a fresh white linen coat. And he personally preferred a white carnation in his lapel.
Oh my god. Was he married?
I don't think so, but I couldn't find any. He preferred a highly polished bar. Had to have white linens, gleaming glasses. So it's like, you figure, if you do it in comparison to saloons, you figure they're just maybe just, you know.
I know lots of guys with that kind of demanding aesthetics, and they're not married either.
No, honestly, that was pretty touching.
But one of the interesting things is that he deplored free conversation with the customers. You were supposed to, as he says, the bartender should answer civilly and briefly every reasonable question that is put to him, but should not enter into protracted conversation with the customer. And that, actually, other things that I read from other bartenders said the same thing. You just don't do that. You don't. You're not their friend. You answer their questions. And again, as I mentioned earlier, he believed that all drinks should be stirred, not shaken. And he says, a stirred cocktail is clear, fresh, and retains its vitality. A shaken cocktail is muddy in appearance and has had so much ice diluted into it, it's a very insipid affair. Right?
An insipid affair.
He claimed to be the first person to bring the highball to America. Now, that's a big claim.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, there was a bar in Boston called, I think it was the Adams House in Boston, also claimed to make the first highball. And he, in his foreword to his book, says there was an article written in the New York Times proves this, that I was the one who brought it. And you go, and it's an op-ed piece written by Patrick. However, what's interesting about the article is that he has a very long story about how it actually came about, which is so detailed that you're like, well, okay, I mean, that sounds reasonable. He actually attributes it, the name and the drink itself, to an actor, a London-based actor, who came to New York and asked for a scotch, and was it a scotch and soda, and he didn't have scotch. And the guy was, the actor was like, what do you mean you don't have scotch? How could you not have scotch? So he said, you need to order scotch. And I should say, at this time, so he left the Ashton House and opened up his own cafe right next to the Lyceum Theater, which is why he had a lot of actors coming in. And eventually, he got the scotch ordered from his distributor. He started serving it, and all the actors were drinking drinks. But he attributes the name to E.J. Ratcliffe, his actor, that he called it a highball, a scotch highball.
Hmm, okay.
And so it sounds like a pretty reasonable story. I don't know why you would go through so much effort to prove it if it was, you know.
I've heard some pretty intricate stories about cocktails that were not valid.
And what's interesting is this is from the time. He wrote this in 1927, calling out the Adams House. How dare they? It's really funny. Like, you're like, whoa, this is a thing where you could, like, be like, how dare you claim?
Yeah, that was the time when philosophers would like pitch hissy fits at each other over minutiae of theory and ideology, and everybody, it's I guess it's kind of like today. It's like the internet, except in print.
Oh, yeah. Except in person. And, you know,
it's almost like because they didn't have phones, they couldn't just call, or, you know, everything had to be in print. And so you'd have to, like, you could set out the screed of hatred on the paper that would, and go to great extents pointing, you know, listing your points and everything, and then put it out there, and then people can digest it, and then talk about it before the person you attacked comes back and levels another long thing.
It could be weeks, though.
You know? Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Imagine having to follow a thread weeks apart.
I know. But
you're
who were into it were probably on the side, you know, on the edge of their seat waiting for the response.
Oh, I'm sure.
It's like, you know, what is Bertrand Russell going to say about that?
Right.
You know?
It was an it was actually a really funny article to read. It's like, you know, the claims of, and here is how the name actually came about. And he, but the thing too is that he, in his book in 1934, he wished for the days of the highball coming back as the premier American drink. And even though it was named by a London actor and presumably came from, you know, somewhere else, he served people like J.P. Morgan, Oscar Wilde, Cecil DeMille. The thing is that all these people were in New York, and he was next to a theater. So when you say, well, yeah, I served Oscar Wilde, Cecil DeMille, who was a theater actor in the early 1900s, and Edwin Booth, one of the premier actors of the time, is like, and John Wilkes Booth's brother.
And they were true bar guys.
Right. Like, I mean,
and there's other cocktails where we've discussed how actors have come in and named a cocktail, and it's
And that's, I think, a lot of the problem with naming drinks. It's like, well, give me this. Well, you just created something on the spot. Well, you just wanted this, and now it ends up in a recipe book named something obscure because you decided, because you had a story.
Yeah.
There was one time, that's why it's called the Blinker. You know, who knows, but... So, sort of an interesting character. You know, I'm reading a book where they're talking about the role of bars in America from like the beginning until, you know, present day. And, you know, a lot of it's really shady, you know, and so you have these bartenders in the mid-1800s and late-1800s trying to say, no, it's an upscale profession. It's not just pouring, you know, moonshine into a cup and letting people, you know, go blind and then you steal their money.
Put them onto a ship to China.
So,
well, now the cocktails are gone, and I already miss it.
I know. That was a good one.
That was a really good one. I don't know. I guess that's pretty much it. This past weekend, we went on a field trip to a wonderful place called Billy Sunday and tried their drinks. I failed to mention earlier that when I said we are here, we are actually at the Brixton here in Andersonville in Chicago, and they make some mighty fine cocktails. We come in, we sit down, point at our little book, and they're like, okay, that's awesome, and they're you know, and they give it a shot, even if they've never done it before, and I'm quite happy with it. So
it was delicious.
But. Like I was saying, we went on a field trip. I expect we'll do more of those because that was a damn good time.
It was some interesting cocktails.
But the conversation was really awesome too. And like just sitting around talking about everything as we tried it. I mean, these were brand spanking new cocktails, like things that nobody's ever heard of before.
Goat's milk.
Yeah, goat's milk.
What else?
Monk's pepper. Yeah, strange ingredients. But
it's warm stuff.
It's the kind of thing that you find nowadays in the world of cocktails, especially here in Chicago. So if you follow us on Twitter or on Facebook, you will see us setting up for more of those, and if you want to, you can come and sit and give them a try, because why the hell not? They're really good, and it's a whole new experience. So I guess that's pretty much it. We can wrap up. This is Cameron Marceau and Jason Cruz signing off. If you're into thinking and drinking, come and black your liver with us. Until next time, bye now.
The Blinker, 2 ounces, Old Overholt Rye, 1 ounce, Grapefruit Juice, 1 teaspoon, Raspberry Syrup. We'll be right back.
And we're here at the Brixton, tasting the Blinker. Now, we're already at the Brixton tasting the Blinker, but the regular gang did not get to taste the Blinker, so they must taste the Blinker. To my left is Nicole Pizzini.
Hi, Cam.
Nicole, is there something that you used to like in your or that you hated in your childhood that you like now?
Black licorice. Oh, and coffee and beer.
Wait, you hated black licorice when you were a child, but now you like it?
Yeah, all three of those things I like a lot now, and did not like it all as a kid.
The licorice one kind of stuns me, because I figure that, like, you either do or you don't. I feel like it's genetic coding. But also here is Bethany Lang.
Hello.
And Bethany.
Yes.
Is there something that you did not like in your youth that somehow transitioned when you got older so that you could enjoy it?
Brussels sprouts.
Did you really eat Brussels sprouts and try them before when you were a kid?
I tried them as a kid, and I hated them. My mom really liked them, so every once in a while she would get me to try them.
Do you know why you changed over to enjoy Brussels sprouts?
Because they're delicious.
So it just happened one day. You ate one, and it was like, oh my gosh.
I've had several things like that, actually, because I've heard that, like, your taste buds change, what is it, every, like, 7 years or something? And I've had several situations. Black licorice was one for me, too, where I, like, woke up one day, and I was like, this is delicious.
I always loved black licorice.
Oh, no, I hated it when I was a kid. I thought it was revolting.
I don't understand that. Okay. We're also joined by Rachel Rubin.
Oh.
And you. Do you have something that you eat readily now that you didn't like when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, I didn't like... I remember not liking pizza for a while.
Yeah. Everybody just, like, went crazy.
I didn't like pizza for a while when I was a kid, and I like pizza now. I don't know. The rest, like, I'm thinking of, like, other things that I didn't like when I was a kid, and most of them are stuck. I eat just about everything, though. There's only a couple things that I really just don't like. I guess zucchini's the other one. I didn't like zucchini when I was little.
Yeah, you eat zucchini?
I eat zucchini all the time now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I still don't eat zucchini. And also here is Kevin Ratajczak.
Hey, guys.
How about you?
Mustard is a big one. Like, I didn't like mustard when I was a kid.
All types of mustard or just the fancy mustard?
I think starting with just the yellow, like, on your hot dog kind of mustard, and then I would try the, you know, Dijon, all that, and I didn't like it. But the older I got, the more I kind of appreciated the spices and the bitterness of mustards and things like that. Another kind of bitter tasting things I like much more now as an adult than I did when I was a kid.
Do you like the French's yellow mustard or the Dijon better?
That's an excellent question. It depends on my mood. I actually really do like the French's sometimes.
Fair enough. How about grapefruit? Do you guys like grapefruit now?
I love grapefruit now. I love grapefruit as a kid. Grapefruit is the best fruit.
No, it tastes like bile.
It does. It has that same feeling in the back of your throat.
As a kid, I wasn't a big fan, but the older I got, the more I started like it. And plus, I swear, I've been on the verge of getting sick before and had grapefruit juice, and immediately I was feeling better.
You know what? I didn't like grapefruit that much. I've acquired a taste. I actually heard from somebody about the curative powers of grapefruit juice. And so if I start feeling sick, I go grab a giant bottle and drink it over the course of the day, and all I get is a stomach ache. Because usually, like, you just get sick anyway.
Yeah.
So I high cholesterol runs in my family, and I learned that there's a bunch of cholesterol medicines that if you take them, you can't eat grapefruit anymore.
Yeah. It's
and so ever since, I've just been, like, binging on everything that has grapefruit in it, so I can just get it now before I have to go be on medicine or something.
Why is that? They interact somehow?
Yeah, it prevents your body from getting rid of excess of the drug. So the drug just builds up and builds up, and then you overdose.
There are some, like, mental health drugs, too, that are the same way. You can't have grapefruit with them.
Yeah, so because it blocks your body from expelling them.
So there's some sort of chemical.
Yeah.
That's messed up. Grapefruit for me is, like, the old people fruit.
Yeah, I can,
like,
kind of see that.
People really love some grapefruit.
and some prunes, man.
I love prunes. It's so much better than orange juice.
I love dates and I love prunes.
It's so good.
Like, grapefruit versus orange juice, no contest.
No, I agree with Rachel. So it gives you, like, that same, like, in the back of your throat, like, style.
It's good.
How about pink versus white? Preference?
I feel like the ruby, the pink, tends to be a little bit sweeter. And so I do steer that direction normally. But I will have the white.
Yeah, I got to agree with the pink grapefruit's usually sweeter. So I go for that one.
So yeah, this is the grapefruit drink. This is the blinker, and it's...
Yeah,
and the cool thing about it was the grapefruit story and how, like, nobody liked it. Jay said that the only recipe that he found, they scooped the pulp out and served like a salad or something in the rind.
I like grapefruit flavored things, like, yes. like Fresca and 50-50.
Hell yeah. And those sun-kissed fruit gems, those little circle things. Oh, the grapefruit ones are the best ones.
That is freaking great.
Yeah, those things are
good. Forgot about those.
Oh, they're so good.
Jeez.
I could eat those for days.
Anyway, what are they? Are they like gummy things?
Yeah, they're like these, they're like little circles and they're gummies.
We talked about fruit gems before. Kevin
yeah.
Very
yeah, it's one of my favorite sweets.
And
I'm not big into sweets.
In sugar.
Yeah, but those are one of my
and
favorites.
And you bite into them, they're kind of like gummy and. Oh, they're so good. And they're all citrus flavored, like orange, grapefruit,
oh, yeah.
like lemon.
Those sound like the worst candy ever.
No, they're so good. You can only find them like bulk candy.
Only citrus.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't see them very often. When I see them, I'm like, I'm gonna buy that shit. Because they are delicious. Next time I see some, I'll buy you some.
You know what? I will cheat on my diet.
For some sun-kissed fruit gems?
Yes, I will.
I had some 50-50 yesterday. Me and Kevin had 50-50 yesterday.
I always forget Fresca's grapefruit flavor.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
right.
Squirt, Fresca, 50-50.
Squirt has the worst.
Not really.
No?
It's artificial.
It's vaguely.
That's probably why Rachel and I...
Yeah, exactly.
It's sort of like Sprite is lemon-lime, quote, quote.
Yeah, Sprite doesn't taste like a lemon
and then Sprite is grapefruit, quote, quote.
Yeah, Sprite is basically sugar water.
That's what it all is.
Yeah, like, and, like a lime looked at it.
Oddly, too, rust remover. I saw somebody on YouTube clean the rust off of their truck bumper with Coca-Cola.
Yeah, I think MythBusters did that, too.
It's pretty amazing stuff.
It's acidic and it's carbonated, so it would make a great cleaning solution. My dog came up today.
So he didn't have to go to school.
he didn't have to go to the vet.
Tell him when he grew up.
He ate a giant mushroom.
Whole.
And then barfed it in my house.
The entire thing. Completely formed.
And now, because it was a mushroom and not like any other piece of food, we have to test his blood work to see if it's poisonous. So we don't know where he got it.
So Doug is dying of a poison mushroom right now.
See, this is a sign of the times.
Why?
You know... Back in, like, in the 50s or earlier, probably the 80s or earlier, it would have just been like,
buck
sucks.
Up. Yeah, buck up, Buttercup.
Hope you don't die. Like,
now, there could
like,
be a blood
now,
draw.
Now, gerbils are barely disposable. It used to be anything with four legs was a disposable creature.
Gerbils are barely disposable, you say? So what isn't disposable?
I've heard of people taking gerbils to like the vet and stuff like that.
So if gerbils are disposable, what's the level above gerbils that is not?
Rat.
I think people take care of rats. I think when you're looking at insects, maybe reptiles. I mean, there's only so much. What could a vet do for a reptile?
All kinds of stuff.
My brother-in-law's taking his leopard gecko to the vet.
How big is one of those? Yeah, that's disposable.
You just throw it away.
So are you saying like animals smaller than a dollar bill? Is that like maybe the guideline?
Unless they're made of diamonds. I don't know.
Like
I haven't thought this out.
I'm wondering about your rule of thumb, Cam, on like what makes
I actually have none. It's just like a feeling. I just know that like there are people who take their small rodentia to the vet.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like
look at any bad Western from, you know, more than 10 years ago. The horse falls down.
Yeah, you shoot it.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah. Do they do that still? Like,
I don't think in movies.
I mean like in real life.
In real life, yeah.
It's like a farm.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, one reason is it's really hard to like. How are you going to move a horse from point A to point B?
Yes. Yes. And a horse can't recover from that.
But that's on a farm. It's a piece of equipment. It's not like a house pet. Like somebody who competes with horses and like is very close to a horse probably would not shoot them.
Actually,
horse.
With the competing with horses.
Well, the competing, they shoot.
Them. Yeah, they do.
But
they,
like,
yeah.
There are people with no horses problem. Like as pets, you know.
Yeah.
And that you probably wouldn't shoot your horse if it breaks its leg.
But see, that's my question: is if the idea is to euthanize a horse that breaks its leg, even if it's a loved animal, because
recovery
so much worse
and
yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the lot.
You can't give a horse crutches.
No, that's true.
They don't have
and
garbage.
Its crutches can't sign its cast.
It has the little wheels behind, the whole back half in plaster.
People euthanize their dogs. I mean, the line is quality of life.
Well, maybe that's why all gerbils and hamsters should just be euthanized right now. They live in a small glass house in wood shavings.
And they go on a wheel, they poop and they're constantly running on their own.
Aren't some gerbils just used as snake food?
Oh, yeah.
Some rodents, yeah.
Well, but I mean, if you
is that where we're drawing the line is snake food?
I had a cat who, like, grew a blood clot, and he was otherwise healthy, but he was paralyzed in his back legs, and he was obviously, like, in pain and stressed out, like he didn't understand what had happened to him, and they said that he would never recover his movement in his back legs, then he would eventually throw another clot and die. And we were like, well, why wait around, you know?
Well, hopefully my dog did not eat poisoned mushrooms.
I'm sure your dog did not eat a poisoned mushroom.
He ate delicious poisoned portobello.
I really think that's probably
yeah,
what
yeah.
He enjoyed it, except for the fact that he was sure.
What a dumbass dog.
I liked your hypothesis, though, which was, oh shit, they're going to see me if I have this mushroom. I better swallow it whole instead of chewing it.
Yep.
Or else they'll take it away.
Yep, I really think that's what happened. And now...
I mean, that is dog logic right there.
Yeah. Yep.
It's quiz night, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be back shortly. Now, the one closest to me... Well, I'll say this. I made a mix with rye whiskey. One with Old Overholt and one with Rittenhouse. Just to kind of, you know, one's a little bit stronger. They're both classic ryes. They're both excellent. We drink them both by the gallon around here. 2 ounces of rye, 1 ounce of grapefruit, and then maybe 2.5 bar spoons of the raspberry syrup. Raspberry syrup makes it extremely pink, more so than like cranberry. So other than that, it'd be a pretty dark drink. You know, real smooth, real fruity, you know, fruity whiskey. Who doesn't like that, you know? So that's got Overholt or Rittenhouse in it, and that one has the other one.
Smells like lemon oil because of the garnish.
and he rubbed the rim. He rubbed the rim.
Yeah.
He's a rim rubber.
Yeah, this one didn't get the rim rub.
Oh, wait, no, there's the rye. Oh, it's nice.
It starts with the raspberry syrup and then it just ends with sort of like the rye barrel. You don't get any of the bite from rye. You don't get any of the rye burn, nothing like that.
Really?
You just get a little bit of the smell of a barrel, like the whiskey barrel. You just kind of get a little of that woody kind of spiciness.
Do you taste raspberry?
The one that's on the napkin anyhow.
Do you taste raspberry?
Yeah, the very first flavor is raspberry. In fact, that's the majority of it. And then you just get that sort of rye aftertaste.
Do you think it's too synthetic-y?
It is a little raspberry candy-y.
Okay.
Rather than tasting like, oh, I had some fresh raspberries before I came here. They were much more tart.
I mean, just thinking back to something that would be made in the early part of the 20th century.
if it were an actual fruit syrup, you'd probably get more of that grapefruit coming through. You know, you get more of that tartness. As it is, it's pretty sweet.
But I do like it.
Yum.
Yeah, it's mostly raspberry.
That is delicious.
Oh yeah, this one, you get a lot more rye up front than the other one. Can you
get? No, I definitely taste the lemon, the oil on the lemon.
I like this one better.
Really?
There's a strange flavor in this one.
I like this one better.
I get so much of the oil, the lemon oil from the...
I like this one better too.
I like the raspberry syrup.
Yeah. I'm not getting that grapefruit though.
Good.
No.
Yeah, so, I don't get it either.
It could definitely be from an era that was not used to drinking grapefruit yet, because it does not taste like grapefruit.
If the raspberry syrup was more subdued.
Yeah, it might come through then. Then again, it might just get blown away by the rye. Who knows?
That is delicious.
That is so good.
Yummy. Does anybody else almost get like a little bit of an almondy flavor?
I was going to say coconut.
Okay, yeah. Like.
But I feel like I say coconut too much.
No, but I think we're getting the same thing.
Yeah, I think so too.
Maybe it's a little bit of a nuttiness.
And like that's probably the wood that Nicole was talking about.
Oh, you think?
Yeah, from the barrel.
Yeah.
I like it.
The aftertaste on this one is quite good, though, as it like sits there and you're like, okay, yeah, I want more some more of that.
I mean, I of course like the one that tastes like whiskey more, but they're both awesome drinks.
So, we sampled them.
And?
It's really interesting because they do not like grapefruit, and they like the one not on the napkin.
Okay, interesting.
The three of us thought both of them were equally good. She liked them both different for different reasons. My palate isn't... I can't tell the difference. Sure. I mean, I think that they're both really good.
Do they both taste similar to you? Or there's a difference, though?
There's a difference, but it's not... I'm not picking it out.
Right.
She did.
Right.
She's
this,
like...
This one tastes more like whiskey.
That one's stronger.
Yeah.
Overholt, yeah. Rittenhouse.
Okay.
Ah. So that's interesting. That's going to be a little stronger. I mean, you know, you do a shot of Rittenhouse for 100 proof, that's a real shot. You do another one, that's a real shot. Yeah. You know, look at that versus Overholt, which is 80 proof.
Okay.
Know? And it's just like, you're talking...
It's a little bit different flavor, too, because we're saying, like, we get a lot of the raspberry, but it has a different finish.
Yeah.
Like, this one is like a straight-up cocktail, and you know this.
A little more heat in that one, all right? And that'll sometimes be confused as spice, but it's a little more heat. And then over here, you know, with a little less heat, you're going to get more of the juices and the acidity, you know? So it stands to reason. It's somewhat of a teaching point. You know, it's just like, it's not just whiskey. You know, it's a very simple drink to make. You use a different whiskey, and you could have, I don't want to say drastic, but if it's something you drink a lot, you're going to notice it.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so Nicole noticed it because she drinks whiskey all the time.
Thanks, Kim.
Can I be a booze hound? Not till you're 16. The Booze Hound song?
Nope.
That was Bart Simpson saying it?
Nope. Is this a generational thing?
You watch The Simpsons, don't you?
Kind of. Not like you do.
Never mind.
Yes, I'm aware of The Simpsons. I wasn't allowed to watch The Simpsons because I was too young.
You're killing Cam. You're killing him. You're killing him. You're hurting him. You're hurting him.
It makes sense, though, that Ray and I would prefer the one we prefer because there's more whiskey in it, so it covers up the grapefruit.
Yeah, that really surprises me, though, Bethany, because you love berry-flavored things.
But I don't get berry flavor from this. I get acidity.
But berry flavor is, like, all I
get berry in this one, too.
I'd be curious to try this with, like, lemon juice instead of grapefruit. That I would probably enjoy.
I'm not.
The lemon oil from the garnish.
Haven't we done enough lemon juice?
Fair. Not with raspberry syrup.
Yeah, that's right.
I like the extra flavor that you get from that, the stronger whiskey.
Just thinking of the drink in general, would you order it again?
Absolutely.
How about you, Rachel?
I don't know if I'd order this, but it's good. I like it.
And it's not tan.
It isn't tan.
It's colorful.
You're right. It's not like peachy tan. It's actually like pinky red.
Fawn.
Nice. No, I don't think I'd order this. It's good. I like it a lot, but I don't think I'd order it.
How about you, Bethany?
No. I'd drink it if someone gave it to me, but I don't think I'd order it.
It tastes a little bit too much like raspberry for me. I'd like it. I'd get this again for sure. I think something that makes this like a good cocktail and not just a good drink is that you can taste the alcohol, yeah, but it's not burning you. You're tasting the good qualities.
And you taste the subtlety of each kind.
And you taste raspberry.
Yeah.
I don't get to taste that very often.
Yeah.
Apparently, I really like it.
I would like to try this with like a black raspberry syrup.
Oh,
I would drink this as a punch.
This would be a good punch.
I would make a punch out of this and serve it. I would not order this at a bar. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
it's that you want to make it and you want to share this with everyone.
And you don't want to be responsible for drinking it yourself.
How pretty would this be in a punch bowl?
It would be beautiful as a punch.
Oh yeah.
Now let's talk about adding a sherbet float to this.
Yes!
Nicole's eyes are like rolling out of her head.
Goodbye, whiskey.
Yeah, I don't know if you can do a sherbet float with rye. I think that's a bridge too far.
I love punches with sherbet floats. Let's start talking about that. When you start talking about making something with a punch, I'd like you to talk about if it can have a float.
Can this have a sherbet float?
Okay, so is everybody blind now?
I will be.
Everybody blinkered?
Blinkered. I feel like a racehorse.
So
if I break my leg, you can shoot me.
And it comes full circle, ladies and gentlemen.
So anyway, I guess that's it. Keep listening, and until next time, bye now. It's kosher. I got it in the kosher section in the kosher Mariano's up in Lincolnwood.
Is there some sort of culturally Jewish food that goes with raspberry syrup?
I don't know.
Maybe it's really good on like latkes.
Or gefilte fish. Raspberry gefilte fish.
I don't think so.
Playground, Dan Cruz for art direction and editing, and Mark Piani for the music at the head of the show. Go to blackliverproject.com to see the show archive, become a member, contribute to the project, and get in touch with us. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get the latest news and, as it happens, updates during live events. And as always, if you're into thinking and drinking, let us blacken your liver.